In July of 2007, construction had just begun for a new housing development in Dubuque when someone found human remains. Over the next 5 years, archaeologists would uncover 939 forgotten graves. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. How could a cemetery of this size be forgotten? That's one of the mysteries archaeologists Robin Lilly and Jennifer Mack worked to solve as an archaeological team spent 5 years recovering remains and studying the graves that were uncovered. They've co-authored the new book, Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. I'll talk with them. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 2007, a Dubuque man was out walking his dog when he spotted something very strange. That something turned out to be human bones scattered around a construction site on a bluff overlooking the Mississippi. That discovery was just the tip of the iceberg. My guests this hour have written a book about this strange story. It's called Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. Robin Lilly is here. She's a skeletal biologist for the University of Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist Burials Program. Hello, Robin.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And on the phone with us is Jennifer Mack. She's also an archaeologist, and she was working for the Office of the State Archaeologist when this discovery was made. She now lives and works in Pensacola, Florida. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Robin, we'll start with you. Let's go back to 2007. A man discovers these bones on a construction site. What happened next?
Well, he first reported his discovery to the Dubuque Police Department, and they contacted the Office of the State Archaeologist Burials Program and asked us to investigate what was going on. This was July of 2007, and at my supervisor at that time, Shirley Shermer, and Cindy Nagel from the Office of the State Archaeologist went to the site, and they found not just a couple of bones, but lots of bones.
All right. And the Office of the State Archaeologist is responsible for remains of what age? I mean, where does your responsibility begin?
Our responsibility is written into the Iowa Code. It was passed in 1976, and the intention of that was to protect all burials in the state of Iowa. Prior to that law, only historic burials were protected, cemetery burials. The law passed in 1976 defined ancient burials as those 150 years old or older, which was fine in 1976 because that covered prehistoric burials, Native American burials in the state, and that was the purpose of the law. But because that of the way it's defined, that date, it's a moving date. So now our office is also responsible for the protection of burials that include the early historic era pioneer cemeteries and burials in the state of Iowa.
All right. And it was immediately clear that these remains were older?
Well, we were pretty sure we knew what we were dealing with because we had a good idea that there was a 19th century cemetery that had been in that location or near that location, but we thought that all the burials had been moved back in the 19th century.
So when this discovery was made, you thought, oh, maybe there were a few graves that had been lost on the registry and did not get moved.
Right. We thought that, oh, you know, there were just a few burials. And what happened was the property had been purchased by a developer. And the reason that these bones were on the surface and scattered around was because they had done some earth moving. And it was in the process of doing the earth moving that they were actually disinterring some of these burials and using the soil for fill in an erosional channel on the property. So the construction workers, the people doing this, they claimed they never saw any bones. It was only later that this was discovered.
All right. So when you were called, you looked at what was there. What were the options? How to proceed?
There were several options. The landowner, the developer, already had plans in place for building a high-rise condominium on the property. So he could have abandoned his plans. That would have been one option. That wasn't an option for him.
Right.
He could have gone ahead with his construction but had an archaeologist on site who would then have stopped the construction anytime a burial was found, if any were found. And the option that he chose was to have an archaeological excavation of the area that would have been disturbed by his construction plans to make sure that all the burials were removed before he started construction. So beginning in August of 2007, I went to the site with a student who was working for me. And we were expected to be there maybe a week or two to remove any burials that we might find. We had a backhoe operator who was, they removed tree stumps, and then they started stripping, very carefully stripping thin layers of soil to see if we could find any grave shafts or any evidence of any more burials on this property.
And what did you find?
At first, we didn't find, we did find a couple of burials during the tree stump removal, but when we started stripping, we kept finding more and more stains. Some of the burials were actually very close to the surface, which was strange. And the more we excavated these burials and moved on to a new area, we just kept finding more and more, and that we ended up using a lot of volunteers, people from our office, to help us remove all those that we did find.
So at what point, do you remember the point at which you thought, oh my goodness, this is a much bigger project than I thought it was going to be?
I think probably by October or so of that year, because we had only really examined a small area. And by the end of the field season, which was in late November, it just got too cold to work, we still had graves that we had already flagged or marked that we did not have time to excavate. And I just thought, wow, there are a lot more here than I thought. I think it was the next year when it really blew up.
All right. So in 2007, you found approximately 90 graves.
Right.
In 2008, what did you find?
About 500 more.
Wow.
And that year, we had a professional crew of field technicians. And that was the year that Jennifer Mack was hired as a field technician. She proved to be incredibly competent and very interested in the project, which a lot of field crew in general, they just do the job. But she was really into it and very knowledgeable about human skeletal remains and historic cemeteries. And so for the last part of the project, she was our crew chief.
So you said just doing the job. What exactly is the job? What do you do on a daily basis when you are out in the field excavating graves?
Oh, well, Jennifer, you want to answer that since you did a lot of that?
Part of the biggest part, perhaps, is watching the backhoe that removes the top layers of soil so that you can see the grave shafts. And once those become visible, then work begins by hand, digging with shovels until you get close to the level of the coffin, and then switching to trowels and bamboo sticks, very small, delicate implements to carefully expose the skeletons and the coffin hardware, any grave goods that are inside, and then lots of paperwork documenting what's found and exactly where. Using GPS to record locations, to make maps, and then photography, of course, and drawings, and then eventually when everything is fully documented, the removal of the human remains, careful packing away so that they could be taken back to the lab along with the artifacts for analysis after the field season.
How long does it take to excavate one grave?
Oh, well, that is highly variable, depending on the level of preservation, how deeply the person's buried, the amount of hardware, the size of the person. An infant grave, of course, is completed much more quickly. There was one day where I excavated 3 infant graves in a single day. On the other hand, our very elaborate burial 868, Robin might know better than I, but I think that took me a week and a half.
I think that was probably right, yeah.
And when you say elaborate burial, what are you talking about?
This particular burial had very good preservation of wood as well as the hardware. A lot of the times in this cemetery and other ones, the metal, the hardware and the nails, that's all preserved, but the wood is not. In this case, the wood was preserved. There was an outer container and then a cloth-covered coffin inside of that. There was a glass viewing pane. There were lots of grave goods, but also there was some fabric preserved, and because of the unusual conditions within this, like the microenvironment of this grave, there were even organics, like a flower that was pinned to the shoulder.
Wow.
Was preserved, so things that you have to be very, very careful around. So it required a lot more photographs as we went through each layer of the coffin, and then also just required being really careful.
Now, what kind of special considerations do you have, Robin, because you're working with human remains? I mean, this is not a typical archaeological dig.
Correct. And there are a lot of concerns, but one of them is keeping the area where we're working away from the public eye, despite photographers from the local paper trying to take pictures and get stories.
I can imagine there was a lot of interest in the neighborhood and all around town.
Yeah, there was. There was a lot of interest. And we also like to be very respectful of what we're doing. Of course, you know, the crew being mostly younger people, when we had breaks or after work, we would socialize and have fun. But while we were in the process of excavation, we tried to keep a very, not sober, but at least respectful demeanor, thinking about what we were doing.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking this hour with Robin Lilly and Jennifer Mack. They're the authors of the new book, Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. And this project was enormous. It took a very long time, and the story gets stranger and stranger as we go along. So stay tuned for that. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Robin Lilly and Jennifer Mack. They are archaeologists who were working for the Office of the State Archaeologist when human remains were discovered in 2007 in Dubuque. They, along with others from the Office of the State Archaeologist, excavated a cemetery that had been almost entirely forgotten, 939 forgotten graves. And they've written about this experience in Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. And I want to talk much more about some of the things that you did find when you were excavating these graves and what you were able to learn from the remains that you studied. But let's talk history for a little while, because I think the question of how could a cemetery that is this large be entirely forgotten is one that a lot of people are wondering about. And Jennifer, I know that you really dug into the history. And this cemetery was one that everybody knew about to start with, right? Can you give me a little bit of a history of this cemetery?
Yeah, this was actually a very big and well-known cemetery. It's very well documented in article after article, newspapers of the time. There were several little controversies surrounding the cemetery. So it was It was very well known. And even when we did our excavations, it was known to people that there used to be a cemetery there. There just came to be some confusion as to whether or not it was still there. We don't have an exact founding date for the cemetery, but it's probable that it started to be used around 1833 when the settlement was founded. We know for sure that it was used before 1836, because that's the year that the U.S. government survey was done, and the 1837 map from that survey shows that area as a graveyard. It was not assigned a lot number or an outlot number, so it was not considered by the U.S. government as public lands for sale. It was already in use.
All right, and it was affiliated with the Catholic Church?
Yes, it was. In fact, the cathedral, the St. Raphael's Cathedral, that it was associated with is just down at the bottom of the bluff where the cemetery is located. One of the main problems early on was that they didn't actually ever purchase this land from the government because it was already being used as a cemetery when the survey was done. You know, a couple of early settlers had supposedly claimed preemption rights to the property and then passed them on to the Catholic Church, but the church never went about obtaining legal title to the original lot in the 19th century. So this became a problem later on down the line, though they did have legal title to an adjoining property that the cemetery expanded onto.
All right, and even before the ownership of the land became an issue, there were other issues with the cemetery not being well taken care of?
Yes, it was an old-style graveyard. It really wasn't a cemetery in the modern sense. It was like a churchyard, a place where you stick the dead and don't think about them too much. It was not neatly laid out. There were lots of complaints in the newspaper about it being overgrown and hogs and cattle roaming inside the cemetery, but part of this was not necessarily neglect on the part of the parishioners. There is an old Irish tradition that holds that it's bad luck to disturb plants growing in a churchyard. So that may have been part of the reason why it seemed so ill-kept, because the majority of the members of St. Raphael's Cathedral were in fact Irish. But they did, there were other members of the church who didn't like it looking quite as bad. They eventually, in 1865, they got together a committee to at least build a fence to keep the cattle out of the cemetery.
And then they wanted to have a wrought iron fence, a sort of a beautiful statement.
Yes, that was the hope.
But not the reality.
The reality was it took them 2 years to even raise enough money for what was probably a very rough wooden fence that was built entirely by volunteer labor. And just when they got that done, there was an item in the newspaper that D.J. Hennessy, the bishop's brother, and Dennis Hartney, the sexton of the cemetery, were arrested for destroying the steps leading up to the cemetery from the cathedral, as well as part of the new fence, with an axe. We don't know exactly why they did this. Apparently, they were trying to stop a funeral procession from entering the cemetery, and we know from other records there was a perennial problem of people burying their dead in the cemetery without having paid for a lot.
Okay, so they were using the graveyard, burying their dead without permission to do that.
Yes. Well, technically, if you are a member of a Catholic church, you can't be denied a lot. But they did want people to pay for them, and apparently some people are not. So that may have been the reason that these two probably drunken people ended up hacking up the steps and part of the fence.
And it's notable that one of them was the brother of the bishop.
Yes.
So there is speculation that the bishop may actually have had something to do with that as well.
Well, no, I personally don't think so. But he turned around and announced that the cemetery was closed the next week. I believe it was within a week of that event. He said, "Oh well, you know what? The cemetery is closed anyway." So it was already by then very full. Even though it's a large property, it was originally the only Catholic cemetery in a rapidly growing town that also had a lot of strangers passing through because it was a point on the way westward. So it was, and there were other problems with it being so neglected. Originally, when it was founded, it was outside of town, but as the town expanded, you know, now it was surrounded by houses, and as Mayor Knight called it, it was the spectacle of a cemetery abandoned to desecration in our midst.
So Mayor Knight plays an important role in this story as well, and Bishop Hennessy, who said that the cemetery is closed, although burials kept happening. Records show that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Bishop Hennessy opened it.
All right. And Bishop Hennessy went away to Rome.
Yes. Well, the story starts a little bit earlier than that. What happened is in 1867, the city decided they were going to make improvements to 3rd Street, which forms the northern boundary of the cemetery. It was little more than a muddy cow path. And they thought it was reasonable to have an assessment fee on everyone who had frontage on 3rd Street to help pay for these improvements. But when they went to Bishop Hennessy, he didn't want to pay. First, he filed a petition for exemption because so much of it was cemetery, and then he just outright denied ownership of the land, which in fact was true because they never obtained title from the U.S. government. But this is the beginning of pretty bitter enmity between Mayor Knight and Bishop Hennessy. So the mayor waited until the bishop was out of the country in Rome, and he just announces that he has leased out the mineral rights to the cemetery lot. And immediately workmen began apparently digging the bluff below the graves, you know, coming in from the side of the bluff, but certainly very upsetting.
Sure.
Everyone in town.
And what happened after that?
Well, you know, there was a lot of arguing, wrangling back and forth. We have all the editorials from that time period, and it was especially shady because two members of the city council were actually profiting from the lead mining underneath the cemetery. So they had essentially voted to give themselves rights to make money, which I don't think we would think was all right today. But they claimed that they were trying to get a formal title to the land from the U.S. government because it had been abandoned by the church. And meanwhile, a cemetery association was formed from concerned citizens, and they were petitioning Congress for title to the land. And it went back and forth, but in the end, we don't know exactly what happened. Eventually, the mining stopped, either because they were forced to stop or they got all the lead out and didn't want to mess with the land anymore. And the cemetery continued to be used through 1880.
So they're mining or had finished mining underneath, but people were still being buried up above.
Yes. And Congress finally made a decision, not until 1908. This big controversy with the cemetery happened in 1870. And it wasn't until 1908 that Congress decided that the land belonged to the Archbishop of Dubuque.
We're talking about Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery this hour. That's the title of a new book written by Robin Lilly and Jennifer Mack. They are both here with me now. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So between 1880 and really for a very long time, this cemetery was pretty much abandoned, right?
Yes, it went even more into neglect. It became even more of an eyesore. It was subject to vandalism. There were drunks hanging around in it. There was a stabbing that occurred in the cemetery.
And there was a legend that there was buried treasure in the cemetery.
Or somewhere on the bluff. The cemetery occupies only about a third of the whole landform that and somewhere on that landform is where the gold was supposedly buried.
So people are coming to the cemetery in the night and digging for treasure.
Yes, it seems that we found a couple of holes that suggested that was possibly.
And you did not find Kelly's gold when you were digging there, right, Robin?
No. And you really should read the book.
Did you find it?
No. But you should read the book just to hear the story about Thomas Kelly and his supposed golden treasures buried somewhere in Dubuque.
So all of this time, the cemetery is basically abandoned. But there are also, there's talk about the land and the use for the land and what's to be done with all of these graves. So at different times, people talked about disinterment, about moving the bodies, right?
Yes. They started wanting to do that. Well, Mayor Knight suggested that in 1870 because he thought it was an eyesore and because he wanted the land for himself. And there was a new, more modern-style cemetery established south of town in Key West. It's now called Mount Olivet Cemetery. So people wanted to do that, but nobody had any. A few individual families obviously did that, but for the bulk of the graves, not. And then the Bishop Hennessy, well, he had become Archbishop by then, wanted to build a seminary on the bluff, not on top of the cemetery, but on the other part of the bluff, and then there was talk of removing the graves so that there would be a park for the students of the seminary, but that never happened. And then the Mount Olivet Cemetery Association published that they wanted to remove the graves from the bluff and move them to Mount Olivet. And then, a few months later, they changed that to, we're going to clean up the Third Street Cemetery so you can go get your own dead and move their graves to Mount Olivet. And it appeared in the newspaper often enough sort of that people, I think, just came to believe that at some point the graves had actually been moved.
And were the markers moved?
Well, here's the thing.
Did we lose Jennifer?
Are you still there, Jennifer? She's leaving us in suspense.
So
we'll get her back, but Robin, you can pick up the thread there.
When we first visited the area in 2007, we found two headstones that were laying flat on the ground, covered with grass and weeds, really pretty much obscured from view. What happened to the rest of those headstones? We don't really know. I believe that probably what happened was when eventually, the land was purchased by Dominican nuns who built a large building on the south portion of the bluff away from the cemetery. And that building, which was called the Villa, was used for caring for retired nuns, elderly or ill nuns. And before it was constructed, we know there was some landscaping done in the area of the cemetery, and it was after that point that all the headstones seemed to be gone.
Fascinating. So that was built in 1948, and we do have Jennifer back.
Back.
Wonderful.
I don't know what happened.
So we were just talking about how the markers seemed to disappear. In 1948, when the villa was built for the nuns, were there human remains discovered at that point?
Yes, indeed. while I was gone, I don't know if Robin mentioned that they did get a disinterment permit for the graves that were associated with the few markers that were still on the surface. And they took those markers to Mount Olivet, and they dug for human remains at those locations and apparently thought that was all that needed to be done until they started leveling out. It looks like they wanted to level out the bluff in the center so that it would be a nice lawn. And at that point, unfortunately, they probably said, "Holy Moses, there's bones all over the place," because they had bulldozed straight into the cemetery. And now we didn't know what had happened. In our excavation, we simply found that there was a big blank area in the middle of the cemetery.
So that grave, that wasn't reported to anybody?
It was not.
Okay.
They made the decision, apparently, to just press on. And we would never have found out really the details of the story if it weren't for the fact that there was a lawsuit about this land. And in the process, you know, lawyers having huge financial resources that we don't have, they tracked down some very elderly people who were eyewitness to this bulldozing of the graves. And they could report that, yes, they're in this area, just piles and piles of bones were collected. Now, they were supposedly taken to a cemetery at the end of each day. We don't know exactly where or by whom.
But they weren't being excavated. They were being collected as the construction work was being done.
Yes, that is what we understand from for a couple of nursing students from the hospital. One of them had gone for a walk and happened upon the site and just been interested because she was taking anatomy classes. Mm. And so she and her friend had returned on several occasions and seen piles of bones each time.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking this hour with Jennifer Mack and Robin Lilly. They're the authors of the new book, Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. And of course, they not only excavated this cemetery, they've also unraveled the history of this cemetery and discovered how it's possible that a cemetery this large could have been forgotten by so many. We'll continue our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Robin Lilly and Jennifer Mack. They are the co-authors of the new book, Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City. And Robin Lilly is a skeletal biologist for the University of Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist Burials Program. Jennifer Mack is also an archaeologist. She was working for the OSA when this discovery was made back in the late 2000s, and they spent a lot of years working on excavating 939 forgotten graves in Dubuque. And so, Jennifer, to sum up, we've been trying to figure out how it is that there were all of these graves in the cemetery, and somehow no one knew that they were there. So all of the talk of disinterment, moving the bodies, although it never happened, somehow someone moving all of the markers, and we don't know how that happened, but also this building being built on the property in 1948, or at least next door to the property in 1948, and remains being moved, but not reported, not talked about, not cataloged. After all of that, people just didn't think there were bodies there anymore, right?
Right. Up until the 1970s, when the northern portion of the property was sold to someone who wanted to build condos there. And once again, the bulldozers get started, because this was a very uneven piece of ground, which was why it was good for a cemetery and not great for other things. So the bulldozers start with the leveling, and again, human remains are found. And initially, at that time, they did contact the Catholic cemeteries to come and get the remains, which they did, and it was only reported as one or two individuals. But the story from the depositions goes beyond that. I suppose it became too much of a hassle to continue notifying, so after that, they just continued bulldozing graves without notifying anyone. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we do know where that fill dirt ended up. It's underneath another building in Dubuque.
Wow. And then in 1994, there was more construction and more remains.
Right. Yeah, Robin should talk about that because I wasn't around.
All right.
In 1994, there was just east of where this small condominium building was erected in the 1970s, the property was purchased by a private individual who built a very large house on the property. And nothing was reported during the construction of his house. However, when a retaining wall was being put in, and we're talking about the slope up the bluff, so he needed a retaining wall for his driveway. And as they were cutting into the bluff for this retaining wall, they cut through four interments in coffins. And our office became involved at that point also because of the Iowa burial protection laws. And there was a requirement for a disinterment permit. And so we became involved in that and also removed those remains, which were taken to Mount Olivet Cemetery immediately and reburied.
All right,
in the cemetery.
So that incident got some media attention.
A little, yes.
It got taken care of by the Office of the State Archaeologist. But again, it seemed like an isolated incident until 2007.
It did, except I remember my boss, Shirley, looking up the bluff when we were there in 1994 and saying, "I bet there's more up there." And she was absolutely correct.
Now, when you guys were digging these graves, excavating these graves, you know, when we think about a cemetery, we think about nice lines and rows, and you can see where the graves are. And you have a map where you show where all of the graves were, and these dots overlap each other. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to how people were placed in the cemetery.
It may be that initially there were plots that were sold to individuals or to families, but we found very little that looked like things were laid out in rows or were neatly placed. Also, burials were stacked on top of burials. Plots may have been resold, or people who were interring, you know, their deceased family member may have just dug into an area where there was already a burial, so they just placed a new coffin on top of an old coffin. Other burials were disturbed in the process of interments. So it was actually quite a mess. It was very difficult to make any sense
sort
of it.
Out, yeah.
Yes, make
well,
any
you
sense
even had
of it at the
one
time.
One coffin that you excavated that had remains of other older burials in the coffin.
Well, they weren't inside the coffin. They were around the edges of the coffin. So apparently when this grave was dug, they must have disturbed at least three other burials. And instead of just, you know, being disrespectful and taking the bones away, the grave diggers put the bones back in when they covered the new interment.
So that interment was surrounded by other skeletal remains.
Yes.
And
I'm sorry, go on.
No, Jennifer, what did you want to say?
I was just saying, in that one particular instance, what was unusual was that they were around the outside of the coffin, but they were inside the outer crate.
Okay.
So they did have a lid on top of them, which was unusual. In other cases, they were just, you know, left in the burial outside of everything, but in this case, they were inside the outer crate.
Now, we have a lot of questions from people. We need to get to a couple of calls here. Somebody wants to know exactly where the cemetery is located. We've called it the Third Street Cemetery. So if you were in Dubuque, where is it?
It's just off of Third Street, up from Bluff. If you know where St. Raphael's Cathedral is, if you stand in front of the cathedral and look due west, it's at the top of the bluff. It is still private property. It's still owned by the same individual that bought it in around 2000. It's not there, as far as I know, there's no construction going on. The last time, just about every time I go through Dubuque, I check, and I haven't seen any activity on the site at all.
Now, I can imagine that you were incredibly overwhelmed by the number of bodies that you had to excavate. What were you able to, and just briefly, what were you looking for when you were studying these remains? What can you learn from these bodies?
A lot. We can learn a lot, but we try to determine age, sex for adults. We look for cause of death, if that's possible. We look for disease processes that leave evidence on bones. We look at the health of the population through other kinds of disease or dental anomalies that occur because of either nutritional or disease-related stress. So there's a lot that we can say about them. We found some really interesting things that I guess I hadn't expected, having most of my career dealing with Native American remains and prehistoric remains, that these people liked to smoke pipes and habitual use of a pipe leaves notches in your teeth. And we found that in not just men, but also in some of the women.
Oh, interesting. Let's go to the phones. Chris is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi, and you grew up next to this cemetery?
I did. I grew up right just immediately west of that cemetery area. And during the 70s, we used to play baseball on that cemetery almost every day.
Did you know it was a cemetery?
Well, that's the thing, is that it wasn't that much of a mystery to us because there were a lot of older people that lived in the neighborhood who were well aware that that was a cemetery and that there were probably still bodies over there.
Interesting. So it was something that you talked about?
Oh, yeah. It was something that everybody talked about in our neighborhood. And, you know, we spent a lot of time playing baseball. And in the wintertime, the nuns had sort of a flat area behind the building, and they would fill it with water, and it would ice over, and we'd ice skate over there. So I spent a lot of time dancing on those graves.
Well, oh, God.
Chris, thank you so much for calling.
All right.
Thanks a lot. And how many people do you think were actually buried? I mean, we were talking about 939 graves that you excavated, but obviously a lot happened to this ground in the intervening years. How many people do you actually think were buried in that cemetery total?
We did some calculations based on density within of graves within the area that we excavated, which was only about a fourth of the total cemetery. And somewhere between probably 5,000 and 8,000 graves could have been on that property when it was supposedly closed.
Jennifer, you did a lot of work to actually try to identify individuals who were buried in the cemetery. And of course, the markers were gone. And many people, I mean, you don't bury people with an ID card. So there's not a lot of identifying information. But you actually were able to track down some people who were buried there, right?
We were, in fact. A total of about 13 people were identified or tentatively identified from two different families. And it wasn't all me, of course. I just worked to connect what Robin found in the osteological analysis with what we could find in the historic documentation. But really, the key element for both of these families was a lot of coffins used to have a plaque, or in this case, a cross, on the lid, engraved with the name of the deceased, the date of death, age at death, that sort of thing. And these did not preserve well in the soil of the cemetery. They were not really intended to last. You know, they only had to look pretty for the funeral, so they were made of very cheap metal. But we did have two silver-plated ones that were preserved well enough to be able to read a name or a partial name. One of them was William Murphy. And William Murphy was a gunsmith who was Irish and came to Dubuque with his family. Well, as an older person, he already had adult daughters who moved there with him, actually, with their families. And we found his grave, you know, clearly labeled William Murphy. And we're fortunately, because he was a prominent enough citizen, we found his obituary and then could do more research from there. And then we just looked at the osteological and grave goods information from the graves surrounding him to see if any of his family members were buried nearby. And in fact, it very quickly became clear that his wife, Cecilia, was buried right next to him because she had preceded him in death by 1 year, died of malaria at the age of 78. And the individual buried next to Mr. Murphy was an extremely elderly woman. So with a nearly identical coffin. So there we have the Murphys. Next to them was a woman with her coffin had an infant coffin on top, and we found documentation that the Murphys' adult daughter, Mary, had been buried on the bluff with her young daughter. So using that information, we were able to say, yes, these four graves are probably the Murphys. And what's great about that is that we were able to actually find descendants of the Murphy family One of them still living in Iowa today in Burlington.
And did you make that phone call, Jennifer?
I did, and it was one of the most exciting things ever.
What was that like?
Well, I called Mr. Lynch. Actually, sadly, has passed away since then. But I called him on the phone and tried to explain really quickly why I was calling, so he wouldn't think I was a telemarketer and hang up. And he said something like, "Well, you just never know what's going to happen when you answer the phone." But yes, and we were able to get in touch with all of the still living descendants of the Murphys that we were able to trace anyway, and their pictures appear in our book.
Wow. And the other family, just very briefly?
The other family was the Blakes, which was a family of 12, the parents and 10 children, 9 of whom were buried in our cemetery. They were also Irish. The father was a brick maker. He established the first brick making concern in Dubuque and did very, very well because when you're building a new town, you need bricks. And we were not ever able to contact those descendants because sadly that the Blakes died out at the generation that was buried in the Third Street Cemetery. Mm. None of the children who survived to adulthood went on to marry. And so there are no descendants of that branch of the Blake family.
Listening to your description of the history of this cemetery, and I mean, there were a lot of unusual circumstances that led to this cemetery being forgotten. But I wonder if, as a student of history, Jennifer, do you think that this could be something that happened frequently?
It happens so frequently. I'm currently working on a very similar case, actually, in Florida. A cemetery long forgotten by everybody.
Wow. So we just didn't keep very good track.
No. We have, I guess, a limited mourning period in the United States, and land is valuable, and there's turnover. You need to use land for other purposes, and, you know, especially the graves of people. I think the Dubuque case is a little more unusual because so many prominent people were buried in the cemetery, but poor farms, poor house cemeteries, or any cemetery with less permanent markers and less prominent people, they're more likely to be forgotten.
And Robin, you've been working in the burials program since 1989. So here in Iowa, is this a kind of call that you get frequently to look at human remains that show up somewhere where we don't expect them to be?
Yes, we do get quite a few calls that way, sometimes from the medical examiner's office, sometimes from citizens who were canoeing down the Des Moines River and found something on a sandbar. But as far as the project in Dubuque goes, it was the largest project ever taken on by the burials program, and it went from 2007 and ended in 2014. So those kind of projects don't come up very often, and we hope they don't.
And you dug through years of flooding and in the cold and in the snow, and I'm sure there are so many more stories we could tell if we had more time. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Robin Lilly and Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Mack, they are the co-authors of the new book, Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavating a 19th Century Burial Ground in a 21st Century City, published by University of Iowa Press. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.